Morning, everybody, and welcome back to the Equidemia podcast. Science and soulfulness for equestrians is our motto, our passion. And today we are having Andrew McLean on the podcast, and I'm very excited to welcome him here. Andrew is a fantastic scientist, but also a very experienced rider and trainer. And has been contributing to the development of science-based equestrian training very, very much. And I would say that the training as we know it nowadays, or the training theories that we are using nowadays for a big part, are your contribution. I'm very glad to have you here today, and thank you for your time. Good morning, Andrew McLean.
Yes, thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to be here.
You have started your career with equestrianism, or did you start with your scientific career? What
That's a
was your
good
entrance
question.
to the horse world?
Well, I started with both, really, because I came from what we call here a horse background. My parents, in fact, my grandfather in Queensland was a show jump rider early on in the 1900s. And my father and mother both rode horses, and my mother was a well-known trainer. And so I really grew into it with my three brothers. So horses were a part of our lives. And then we moved to King Island, which is a little windswept island in the middle of Bass Strait, which is between Australia and Tasmania. And there it was much less regimented sort of riding. We would just chase kangaroos and had a lot of fun on horses. It was very wild, and we collected. I was interested in all animals, and that it was really King Island that gave me the very strong passion for zoology. And so when I would ride horses after school, I would go down to the lagoons, which is like small lakes, and collect snakes and birds' eggs and raise the birds and things like that. I had a pet seal. It was a really great existence. But that's really what gave me that passion. And so I did zoology at university. And then I was fortunate enough to get a job at the university almost straight away teaching zoology and biology and a few other related subjects like genetics. And so I did that as well as train horses. And at that time, I was now competing in eventing or show jumping and eventing, military, I think it's called in Europe sometimes. So I was competing and getting to a higher level. I got into an Australian team in 1989, and I really wanted to know if I could do a better job training. So I started to research all of the areas of equine learning and cognition, but there wasn't much to research. In fact, there was pretty much nothing.
There was
There was a
nothing.
little bit of so there was a little bit of adaptation from human psychology, but that was about it. And then I decided for two reasons to move to the mainland of Australia. I had a young family, and I wanted to get into an Olympic team. And the selectors said to me that I couldn't do that in where I lived in Tasmania at that time, because I went to school in Tasmania. I couldn't do it, and I went to uni there too. So I couldn't do it there, so I had to move to Victoria. But I also had a very elderly grandmother. My parents had passed away, and so I wanted to be near her, and I also wanted to go further and do a PhD in horse psychology. And so all of those things came together, and we moved here to the mainland of Australia, and that's where the two came together when I did my PhD, and I also established the Australian Equine Behaviour Centre. And it just started to answer the questions that I had always been asking, because people would say to me, people who I really respected and were very good horse trainers at high levels, they would say, well, I would ask them, why does the horse do this? And they'd say, well, the horse loves to please people. And I really thought that was a bit ridiculous. I couldn't see why a horse would want to please anybody but itself. It was a very human-centered view, and I, as a zoologist, I saw through that and thought, there's got to be other reasons for it. So that's how it all started for me.
And your PhD, you did in equine cognition and learning, right?
Yes, that's right. I really wanted to know what, how similar or dissimilar they were to us in our way of thinking, because, we speak of horses as if they're people, and it's understandable too, because, we're so close to horses as we are to dogs, and horses have been so pivotal in our own development as a species, in recent years, in the last few thousand years. It's enabled us to conquer other lands, and some historians have described the horse as the first weapon of mass destruction, because people could invade other nations and faster and go places. But it's also iconic because, for other reasons other than war, it also the horse, worked so hard for us, and it's a beautiful looking animal with power and strength, but also a kind of benevolence that is surprising to us when we look at it in that anthropomorphic lens. And then more recently, with a horse in sport, and the horse as a companion animal, it fills so many needs, and it gives us a narrative that is almost inescapable. We can't help talking about the horse as partner, and the horse as friend and worker and sports partner, and all those sorts of things. So it's very complex in our psyche, I think.
Yeah, I guess you're right. That is my experience, at least also when I'm working with students and how they're describing their horses and everything around it. It's not always for the benefit of the horse when we are humanizing so much.
No, exactly. Anthropomorphism, where we give horses and other animals human traits, is it has two sides to it. There is a beneficial side, because if it brings people closer to horses, and it gives us a feeling that we can't describe scientifically yet, but we feel very bonded to the horse. And I think for so many ways, we are. When we have very good experiences with the horse, it's a really interesting sort of interspecies communication. But then, on the other side of the coin, if we anthropomorphize the horse too much, it can lead us to start to blame the horse as if it's a culpable human, as if it's the horse's fault, and the horse should know better. And we hear this all the time when we hear commentaries on the horse in sport too, that, the horse is described as if it loves to do what it's doing. And I'm asked quite a lot about the horse as a, because I'm on the board for the Welfare Committee for Horse Racing Victoria, and we have a very strong welfare committee there. But I did some interviews, and people that more than once the interviewers have said to me, "But the horses do love racing, don't they? They love to win." And I'd have to say, "Well, I don't really think they do, but I think there's so many interesting things that they look like they do, because we're so close to horses that when we feel happy about whatever thing has just happened, so much of what we feel is transmitted to the horse. So it's not really that he loves to win, but he's very happy in our happiness, if we have a very strong connection. And that's really what we should be trying to achieve all the time.
What was the moment where you realized that there is really the necessity for a more scientific approach in horse training?
Well, I think it was very much before I began my PhD, I realized there was just no literature on horses, and not much on animal cognition either, really. These were very, I guess, early days of the study of the animal mind. There were a few people who did trailblaze there, and for example, Martha Kiley Worthington, she wrote a book about the about horse behavior, and Lucy Rees, and even a few people before then wrote about horses, but from the lens of human psychology often, because that's all we had to ha had as a model. And then Martha Collie Worthington did change the way we viewed the horse to some extent, because she looked at horse behavior as a species. So I think that was a really big step forward. But my interest was really about the interaction we have when we're training. How does that work? And what do we know? And that was the thing, we didn't know very much.
You have been adding many contributions to the horse world. You have been writing several books about equestrian training. You have been working on the five domain model, what is one of the models that we are at Equidemia using as the base of understanding horsemanship. And of course, the 10 principles of training, what is, I hope, very known so far in the equine industry. Could you walk us a little bit through the process of developing these principles?
Yes, well, that's it's an interesting sort of historical question now, because when I first began, when I was halfway through my PhD, I realized that there were some emerging principles. Excuse me. And so I wrote a book before I actually finished my PhD called Horse Training the McLean Way. And that was the last time I ever wanted to have my name attached to it, because I didn't, once I'd published it, I felt I didn't want it to be about me. I wanted it to be about the horse and something we could build on as an, you know, with ideas as we get to know more. But in that book, I described some principles, and then, to my great luck, I met Professor Paul McGreevy, who's since become a good friend, very close friend, and we began to work together, and. Paul was very already involved in the scientific world, whereas I had not been except for my PhD. So Paul really helped me get through all of this, and we did a lot of work together. I co-wrote a chapter for his book, Equine Behaviour, and then we wrote books and we wrote papers together. And one of the papers was called The Roles of Learning Theory in Equitation. And in that book, we distilled those principles, and I think we still had eight, but they were, I think they were, it was a big improvement on the early ones that I had done. And then we presented these to the International Society for Equitation Science, which pretty much began in 2005, that institution. And through the help of the people on council, because we had a big council of up to 13 scientists by in a few years' time, but by the time it was about 2010, and they very much helped us. People like Professor Janne Christensen, who's an extraordinary scientist at the University of Aarhus in Denmark, and she was a great help there, and so were many others throughout many countries. And we distilled these principles further and finally came up with 10. And then each year at the conference, I would present these principles, because it's a very good introduction for people who are not familiar with learning and welfare, but who are interested in horses, who come to these conferences. It's a very good introduction for them to hear about these principles. So, and at the conference, in France, I forget when that was, 2013, 12, or something like that. But at that conference, maybe it was more recently too. But anyway, at that conference, I decided after speaking with council, that we would reformulate them into much clearer 10 principles, including the principle for safety, because that is a really important one, because horses can be so dangerous if we treat them poorly. And some horses have a higher propensity for dangerous behavior than others, especially if they have a, you know, a troubles in management in their lives and problems with training, which are common. So we do need to be careful about those things. But that was really the origin and the development of the 10 principles. And since then, they've been translated. They're on the ISIS website, of course, and they've been translated into many languages. And so my latest books that I've just finished writing, called Modern Horse Training, it's completely centered on those principles, because almost everything we need to know about horses is within those principles. So that's how I've written it. So there are two volumes, and the first volume is the theory, and the second volume is putting it into practice. And so the 10 principles have been really, for me, profound. And I came to realize quite a long time ago that in medicine we have first principles. And for diagnostic purposes, you need first principles to understand what you see before you as a diagnostician, as a veterinarian, as a doctor, and as a behaviorist. And so first principles are really important, and so too is pattern recognition. So recognizing patterns in behavior. And then those two tools, I suppose you could call them, really help us understand horses, because that's the way all diagnosticians work, is using first principles and what humanity has learned through pattern recognition.
You are using learning theory as a base also for enforcing the 10 principles of training, what also was a kind of new approach to writing, because the writing world I grew up in, now I have a different background, but when I was a child, what I always heard from my writing teacher and what I'm still hearing when I'm going through the equestrian facilities where I'm working is, the horse knows what to do, and the horse knows this and knows that. But you are really applying learning theory for building up language with the horse.
Exactly. I think that's a very good way of putting it, because it is about communication. And it's interesting because, I also work with elephants, and I often use this example to explain to people, because the horse world is just like the elephant world. The elephants, people train elephants, and in some countries they ride them, and they're useful for, in India, for example, they're used for tracking down poachers who are trying to kill rhinos and tigers, etc.
Wow.
So riding elephants in the forest, is there's no better way to get through the forest in a quiet kind of way. But when I was doing my first workshops in Southeast Asia, the background behind elephant training is largely Buddhist and Hindu, and so they would, particularly Hindu, and they would say to me, well, of course the elephant knows what to do. You only have to teach him, you only have to make him do it. And I'd say, no, I don't think he does know what to do. I think you have to teach him. But they'd say, no, the god Ganesh gave us the elephant to serve us, and all you have to do is make him submissive to do it. And suddenly, when I heard those words, I realized all that I've been hearing about horses, because the assumptions are the same. The horse knows how to do it. And that's why people focused on submission, because if you make him submissive, then he'll do it. And then, of course, if he doesn't do it, it's because he's not submissive. So, my life has been so fortunate, because, by sheer accident, I seem to have, that's how I got into the elephant training world, is sort of, it was accidental, but it's been really fortuitous and important, because it really helped me understand horses through a different lens. And to understand the background, because the elephant is just as iconic in Southeast Asia as the horse is to Western Europe and Eastern Europe. The Eastern Europe, the to the particularly Chinese, and those parts of Eurasia. I shouldn't say Europe, I should say Eurasia. So yes, there were big similarities there. So I think we do need to remove that idea that, we only have to let him do it, because we need to teach him, and we need to teach him with good communication, the signals. We need to recognize that if we, and this is what much of my work and interest has been about is it's all good and well to say this is what you do when you ride horses, but are we sure that the signals we use are sufficiently different from each other for all of the different things we want? How does the rider's position fit into all of this? You know, the posture that when we ride certain movements, and these are included in most or many horse sports, postural effects. How does he know the differences between going faster compared to longer in the stride, or slower compared to shorter, or up and down gates? You know, we go up to canter or down to walk or whatever. We need to be sure, and we need to be 100% sure that the signals we use are easily perceived by the horse and that they're sufficiently different. And that is a stumbling block because I have not yet seen a method that abides by those principles perfectly. There are some that are very good, but none are sufficiently, because none began with those principles in mind. So that's, I think, the benefit of the approach that I took, which, you know, was, I guess, accidental, as I said, but is that I was looking at it from a top-down approach rather than a bottom-up approach, where we already had horses, we knew how to ride them, let's just explain it. Whereas I was saying, let's understand it from scientific principle, and that gives us a lot of insights. It also makes riding so much safer. It makes horses calmer and quieter. So, you know, there's every benefit for horses in looking at them in a different way.
Absolutely. That was what got me hooked many years ago onto the academic art of riding, because it was the only equestrian style that I met that had this clear pedagogical approach and said, okay, we need to teach the aids first. And we're doing that on the ground. And then afterwards, we are implementing it into our equestrian training. And it's a little different setup than your training principles, but in basic thing is exactly the same, and that is what I like so much, that we have this very clear equine-centered pedagogical approach before everything else.
Absolutely. And in my books, these two recent books, what I've actually been explaining in the books, and I've even written it on the back cover, is that if people have different signals, that's perfectly okay. They can be superimposed upon this blueprint. But we just need to recognize all the different things that we want from the horse and ask ourselves, is it really clear what we ask of the horse? And that's important. I suppose the other thing that you mentioned that I haven't really addressed was the five domains model, you know, with the welfare. And that was another part of my journey. Was looking into welfare, and again, it was kind of lucky that I did land on that. I think it's been kind of really so fortunate that I came to meet Professor Mellor from New Zealand, who developed the five domains model along with other people like Cat Littlewood and Nyao Beausoleil and people like great scientists like those people. But the project was led by Professor Mellor, and five domains was, you know, is a great model. It's not really about recognizing all of these different needs in the horses and weighing them up against each other. It's really about identifying all the different needs of animals because they can be different too, depending on their affective states. There's some recent science that's just come out about that, about how affective states, you know, how animals feel in any particular day or moment, if they feel, you know, pessimistic or optimistic, and the kind of mood of animals. And we now recognize that animals have these elements to their world like we do. And these also affect or have some kind of effect on the basic needs. But so I was speaking to Professor Mellor and said to him, look, you know, from my perspective, having trained elephants and horses and to some extent dogs, I do know that you can make an animal's life worse through training, and you can also at least make its life comfortable. And the fact that you can really ruin and, mess up an animal's life, to me meant there's a lot more to the behavior domain than maybe is explained at that time. This is before the pandemic. And to Professor Miller's credit, he said, well, let's do it. Let's create a new version. And I think that's the hallmark of a really good scientist. And I know a lot of them, and many of them are like that, I have to say. But it's a really great sort of hallmark of a good scientist that they're prepared to let go and improve the model. And that's the kind of scientist I've always modeled myself on from the people that I knew who I admired in the scientific world that don't hang on to an idea. If there's better evidence out there, then adapt and change. And so that's what happened. And so we developed this 2025, it's called the 2025 Domains Model. And I think, and that's been immensely successful. I think as a scientific paper, it's been downloaded now more than 100,000 times, which is, I've never had a paper or know of any other paper that's been downloaded that many times. So it's quite outstanding, and I'm really proud to have been in that team.
You should be, and I hope you get many, many more downloads. We will also link it in the show notes because it's such an important model that is really adding to equine welfare. Very much. And I listened to one of your talks where you were talking about the memory of elephants and how you can mess up an animal's life with training, and that elephants are very, have this long-lasting memory and are even going after humans years later when they got treated badly.
It's extraordinary. And when I first heard this, I was very skeptical as to why and how they would do this if they really could, many years later. But I've been working with academics in Southeast Asia, particularly people like Vivek Menon, who is the head of the Wildlife Trust of India. He's a scientist as well as these roles. With the Wildlife Trust, and he's assured me that this is so, and that there's been so many stories of elephants breaking free and running through the village to the house where the person lived who did these things to them. But see,
Wow.
elephants, it's really interesting, but elephants are not domestic animals. There's a wild streak in all elephants because we haven't selectively bred them like we have with horses. Changed the morphology of horses, and we haven't altered their behavior a lot, except that we've made them very tolerant through developing what we call tameness, or really it's about habituation. And so horses habituate to so many things now, they tolerate so much. Elephants don't. And so it's easy to make an elephant angry through problems in training and welfare. So the death rate from elephants is actually much higher than it is with horses, and it's high with horses. It's the most dangerous animal in the Western world. The statistics are awful with horses, but they're even worse with elephants.
Do you also see that with horses? That they have this long-lasting memory and can exactly pinpoint and say, you did that to me.
It's not so obvious with horses, and so I wouldn't say that that's true. But it could be, but I don't know of it at all. I just know that with their great memory, horses have an extraordinary memory as well. That is very, I wouldn't be at all surprised. And I have heard of horses being perpetually nervous with people who've, treated them badly, and come with others. And I've had that. When we had the Australian Equine Behaviour Centre, we had a caseload of 20 to 25 horses all the time that had behaviour problems. In one way or another, often there were management problems, but behavior problems, sometimes pain. We had to try and distinguish pain from training, which even nowadays is not always easy.
Difficult.
And but we have better models to do it now, but we didn't have so much then. So I used to give horses butazolidine and phenadine to in order to get rid of any possible pain to see if that was the cause. And sometimes it was, but sometimes it wasn't. And sometimes the horses would just hear the owners when they came to collect them, and they would be immediately nervous. So I think they have that memory, but the horse is not, is nowhere near as aggressive an animal as an elephant when things go wrong.
Oh, one more question to the principles of training. One of my friends here on the farm is in your ISIS course, and she's also a great scientist herself in the field of neuropsychology and biology. And we are having these ongoing discussions about how to teach things best.
Oh, that's wonderful.
What is lovely, right? I love that because you're getting a little bit home blind otherwise if you don't have other people to discuss with. One of the main differences in your approach and my approach is that I am starting to teach body language first and then put the cues on top of it. I'm using body language for teaching cues, while the ISIS approach is exactly the opposite way around. You're taking the body language out and use the cues. Self-standing, basically. Why have you decided for that way? There's a pretty good reason for it, I'm sure.
Yeah, there is. Because the cues that we teach, there are many of them, but if we separate them into two groups, we have cues that they learn by classical conditioning, and that includes body language. And then we have other, we don't call them so much cues, I suppose, but they're aids that we use, for example, using the reins. With a bit through the mouth and our legs on the horse's body. And those work on pressure. They're basically
Pressure
learned by
release.
negative reinforcement, yeah, through the removal of pressure. And reinforcement contingencies are really foundational to animal learning in that you can build cues on. You can do it the other way around because you can also go, you can, there are so many ways of doing things because classical conditioning is really interesting. You know, that was the Pavlovian thing where, you know, the scientist rang the bell and just before he gave the meat to the dog with the meat powder, and the dog salivated, and very soon he rang the bell. And that contingency of those things where, you know, ringing the bell, salivating and getting the food is a major part of classical conditioning. But there's also ways where in classical conditioning where you can have a big gap. You can have ringing the bell and then a gap, and that's delayed conditioning and trace conditioning. You can also have compound conditioning where you can do it at the same time, which I think that's how horses learn body posture when you're riding, that your body posture moves at the same moment that you use the reins to slow down. And horses are very good at that. The only problem with doing that is that if you don't use your body in the right way with the reins or legs or whatever you have coupled them with, then they don't work as well. So you've got to, that's why riding posture is so important. Because if your body says a different thing than your reins, or a body, your body says a different thing to your legs, and your seat, then you don't get the outcome you wanted. The response is dulled. And also, the sorts of horses and clients that I'm dealing with mostly through the Australian Equine Behaviour Centre in my past are people with young horses, and they already have them on a lead rope. And they need to, the horses may be dragging them around, or they might not go forward at all. And they really need to teach them clearly to go from light aids from their head collar and be really obedient in hand and safe in hand. But at the same time, while they're doing that, they're all learning body language too, you know, because the horses are not just focusing on operant or classical conditioning. They're seeing everything. And so it is important to have the same kind of body language each time. And I think that's why the very best trainers also have quite body language, the ones that I've always admired. It's important to be quiet with horses, but there's no doubt that you can do it the other way around. You can, that's the thing. The horses can acquire all of these signals, but it's important to recognize the importance of reinforcement, and that ultimately, for example, when you're riding, although people, say, well, we use our seat to stop, and that's good. It really makes it nice and light. In the perfect world, that's perfect, and that's how you want it to be. But if the horse doesn't stop because he gets a big fright, you're always going to rely on the reins. So you always need that to be the backdrop. And if you don't practice, or if you don't check, how does the horse slow when I don't mean pulling, I just mean closing your fingers as you use your seat. But if we don't practice these transitions, then problems can strike. So I see, for me, it's the interplay of all of these things, the pressure and release, the body language, all of those things. It's consistency is really the biggest thing. That whatever we do, we speak the same language each time.
Thank you very much for this answer. That is taking a big stone off my shoulders. I'm always thinking, okay, where am I going wrong here? I
There are a
usually
lot of good
funnel.
methods. That's why I think it's knowing the principles. When you know the principles, you can try, you could, there are so many roads to Rome.
And it's also, I think, it's very important what you have just been mentioning, that we do make a difference in between the perfect world and the perfect training conditions. And then we are maybe want to cross a road, and then it's very handy if the horse is stopping when there comes a car. So that's the wrong moment for trying to implement something new. There we need to fall back on what we have done the weeks, years before, right?
Exactly. And I think the other thing too that's really important, especially now, because social license is really under heavy threat, and we need to maintain, if we still love to own horses or ride them and be with them, then we really sh these principles are so vital, because they bring us closer together. Because the more I've understood about horses, the more I've understood about training methods that also work. When I was young, I was very much biased towards one particular training style and critical of others. And that's not a very nice place to be, because there's a lot of stress that goes with that kind of thinking. But now I'm really interested in other ways of doing things, and I see that there are so many methods, but many of the methods are too critical of other methods. And if they only realize that we all rely on the same principles, it's to me like language. We may all speak different languages, but the principles of human communication are essentially the same. And we're
Yeah,
essentially the same human beings underneath it.
that's really, really nice. I also think that a writing style should not become a religion. It should become something
Yes,
that we
we should
like
be
to do
open.
as horses.
Yeah.
One of the reasons why I'm really grateful of having you here is because I wanted to talk to you about dominance theory. Something I've been wondering about a very long time. I have a background in dog training, and I am still, I personally don't believe in dominance theory at all. But listening to one of your talks, it was the first time that somebody could explain dominance theory and why it evolved and why it is also, not relevant for us in equine training.
Exactly, yes. That's been a really big area of interest in mine too, because a number of years ago I spent some time on a fellowship with the USA National Sporting Library, where it's one of the biggest repositories of ancient, well, not ancient, but Renaissance and since literature about horse training, some original works there from great trainers. And so to look at these works, you have to wear gloves and it's under glass. It's really quite fascinating. But I wanted to explore those elements of dominance as well as other things. And it has been around for a long time because it's part of the human condition, especially since we've been farmers, so for 10,000 years in humanity. And so in order to keep our crops, and when we grew crops around the Fertile Crescent and around the Mediterranean 10,000 years ago, people would steal our crops, and we would steal other people's crops. And so people started to have to protect them. And so then people needed to arrange military institutions. And, so we had wars, and we still have wars. And it's essentially the same kind of motivations. And so the best way, well, not the best way, but the most effective way to make an army is to go beyond the language and go to religion, because many more people can believe in the same God. And so all of these things are institutions that are really based on dominance, in the sense that you have and we have it in the school, we have it in business, we have it everywhere, where you are the low worker, and you can't just assume a position above you. You have to work for it. And so essentially dominance hierarchies are based on aggression, ritualized aggression, where if you do jump out of your station, you're in trouble. You're not allowed to. You can't just be the private in the army and suddenly become the major. You'll be in really big trouble if you start doing that. And so these things are really part of our traditional culture and that way of thinking is. So of course we applied it to animals. And it came about also because when learning theory was evolved, first of all, as a science in North America, it quickly became squashed and forgotten almost, because the social conservatives in America didn't like the idea of reinforcement. That, that, for example, Skinner and Watson, who developed learning theory very much, they would proclaim that you can teach people to become better than they are. So you could, if you could teach a peasant to become a lawyer, basically. And the social conservatives in the USA didn't like that. And so Skinner lost his job. His students never got jobs. The word operant conditioning never appeared in a scientific paper in the USA for about 20 years. And so in place of that came the science of ethology and animal behavior, which was great, but it never explained anything more than the behaviors that they saw in the wild. And it was easy to use dominance theory then too, because there were studies on chickens. I think it was Ebel Ebelsfeld. No, Sledrup Ebbe, that's right, in Netherlands, who described the pecking order in chickens, and everybody loved that, So we all jumped on that bandwagon and said, this pecking order hierarchy describes all animals, and so dogs live in a hierarchy, and so do horses. And the first papers about the social behaviors of wolves also described that pecking order, and that's because these studies were done on Île Royale, where the wolves were reintroduced. They weren't natural populations. But when they started to study natural populations, I think there was a scientist called Metz. He started to say, hang on, everybody, it isn't a hierarchy. Wolves are family animals. They live in a social expanded family, and you don't see dominance for any resource all the time. Very often you see the male or the female, as people might say, the alpha female or the alpha male, give in to the young dog, which makes enormous sense that we should do that as humans too.
We do that at home too, exactly.
And people also started to describe that with horses and say, let's, hold on. We should rethink that with horses too. But unfortunately, in North America, the New Age horse trainers jumped onto the bandwagon of dominance theory and took off with it, and they loved it. And so everything was explained through dominance, even though in the scientific world, dominance was starting to become unpopular and not explaining what we see very well at all, because we see that animals like horses are dominant for a particular resource with one other animal. So each animal knows its own position in relation to all the others, but it's a mosaic. And also, their dominance for a particular resource over another diminishes as their hunger diminishes, once they've eaten. And it might diminish for many other reasons too. And it's different for each resource. So their need for food might be different for their need for space. So there's really no need for it. But the idea that when it took off in the New Age horse trainers, it's slowly changing, I do believe, because I know that some of them now describe dominance and submission more as in terms of operant conditioning and trialing behaviors rather than necessarily dominance. But nonetheless, it made people start to think that this is something we should apply to horses, and we need to make horses submissive to us. So there were all sorts of terrible techniques that evolved from that, where people might then decide that if the horse is not doing very well in training, whatever you're trying to teach the horse, or if it's been aggressive, just tie it up for an hour and make it think about it, as they would say, or teach it a lesson. And those things never work, or probably it makes it very tired or unwell, but it doesn't solve the behavior problem.
No, it creates new problems. But we are still, I mean, we are still, I am still hearing that when I'm going out for education or I'm also taking courses in advanced education, also for treatments, I'm an equine osteopath, that the horse doesn't cooperate or that you shouldn't go under the lead rope or something because the horse is so dominant, should not get into a dominant position. I'm always
Yes,
smiling a
yes.
little bit. Thank you.
And people do it
If
all
this is
the time, don't
your
they?
major problem, then yeah.
And it actually creates problems, because then when you see it as a dominance problem, you treat it as one using aggression, and then or some other thing that's bad for its welfare. But then all you do is make the problem and other problems worse. And I think that's been a big lesson for me. To learn about that, because I also thought that, I'm originally a zoologist, and animal behavior was gave us the sort of the bare understanding and ethology, a bare understanding of horses' social organization. They're herd animals and all of those sorts of things, and their natural instincts. But I then saw what the people were saying in the USA, and I jumped on that too. I said, that makes a lot of sense. Your horse is dominant, you need to make it submissive. But the things that I was doing were not about dominance. I was just teaching it to lead properly. And so I started to think, that's a ridiculous idea. And I had to think about that seriously and move away from it. And I think my whole life has been like that, is changing what I do, and sometimes through a lot of criticism from people. But every bit of criticism I've ever had has been really valuable for me. I didn't always like it at the time, but it's been really valuable, and I think it should be for us all, to make me rethink what I'm doing and look for a better way to manage things.
This is how we evolve, right? That we are getting a revisiting our ideas and try to improve. Hopefully we try to improve our life long.
Yes, maybe we'll think in some time we'll be different again. I hope so. I hope we continue to move.
I hope we continue to learn and to become better equestrians, and not only in the sense of social licensing, but especially in the sense of having a good connection with this fantastic, great animals. So when we can agree on that dominance theory is outdated, how can trainers and riders shift towards a better method, science-backed methods today? How can we implement that?
I think that there are a lot of ways we can implement it, in education. I think that's a really important way to teach people and to recognize that. I always think that because we're in this really big, difficult position now in the world with losing our social license, there are many different approaches that people have. I don't like the idea of shaming people. Essentially, because I disagree with punishment anyway, and shaming is punishment, and punishment's a really ineffective tool. It tends to, we don't use it in schools anymore. It tends to, because the idea of punishment essentially is to reduce a behavior. But I think when we, if we, instead of educating people, if we shame them and we therefore punish them, if the outcome is usually not to reduce the behavior that they're doing, I think the way we do it is to be more inclusive and in our education styles and recognize the importance of peers, that they people in the world of horse, especially in competition world, they have all of their connections and their friends, and they are people too. So I think the best way is to embark on a more empathic way to educate people. And that doesn't mean we can't tell them what is wrong. I think that we do need to. And I think that's really the great role of scientists to do these studies and show, for example, we're just recent work about the nosebands. We need to recognize that nosebands are bad for horses. I'm not 100% sure that the recent work about 1.5 fingers, I'm not sure on the technology of how they developed that, is that it's any better than 2 fingers. I think that I think the looser the noseband, the better, because I don't even see why we need them. If we could train a horse perfectly well, we should be able to do it with no noseband. We should be able to do it with no bit. If we're good at training, if we are doing something else, then that's a different thing. But people call themselves trainers, and I think if you do, you should be on a journey to do the greatest things with the least amount of force. So as we go through our world with these challenges in social license, I think education is the important thing, but recognizing also the science that we do know nosebands are not great. We do know that there's pressures from curb bits. We do know that tongue ties on racehorses are a really bad idea, and they just basically mask a problem that is really about the stop response, to be honest. If horses have really good, if they're perfectly light to stop and go and turn, they will never need a tongue tie in a race. But trainers don't know enough about learning theory. So in my world, that's why I became obsessed with teaching young people and became involved with Pony Club Australia, and the Pony Club board were very good in enabling myself to and Portland Dr. Portland Jones to write it, and so she was instrumental in getting that going, the alteration of the Pony Club syllabus, and from the work that I had done in my background, and it's been a really marvelous step forward, and so I think children are the way forward, but also with adults too, is teaching them well. And so in my world of in the horse racing world, because as I mentioned, I'm on the Equine Welfare Advisory Council, we have some marvelous learning materials coming up about the five domains and the importance of the of freedom and friends and foraging to horses, that they should be able to touch each other. They need to touch. It's not just good. It's not good enough just to see each other, but they need to touch. But also teaching trainers about negative reinforcement, because before we ever even teach them about positive reinforcement, which is certainly part of their whole process, we need to teach them how to use the reins and all of the instruments they use in a much better way. They don't realize it so much. So when you go to the races here, it's very common to see horses towing people around. The horses have got, they've got their neck really bent, and they're being led, but they're leading the person. They're pulling the person along. So the horse is not in self-carriage. It's not staying in its own speed. It's just dragging the owner along. And what people don't realize is that while the horse is leaning on the bit, the effect of the bit is being detrained. So the horse's brakes are getting worse and worse every single interaction, the more the horse leans. It's the same as true with dogs. If a dog is on the lead, as you see all the time in every city, dogs pulling owners around. And there needs to be a lot more research about the negative effects of dogs pulling owners, because like horses, it can't be a good thing for animals to lean into pressure, because when they do, they're leaning into pain. So whatever, there are all sorts of ways of whitewashing that, but actually that's what's happening. And if we have animals, the best we can do for them is to teach them well, and to teach them to lead really, really well, so they're light. And when you just gently close your fingers on the lead rein or the reins when you're riding, the horse slows down. And all of those things are important, because animals need predictability and controllability in their world. So that comes about through it's in humans, it's like what we call social reciprocity, which is like dancing, or playing tennis. One hits the ball, and that's the stimulus, and other person hits the ball, and it goes backwards and forwards and like that. And I think training is a kind of reciprocal process that, you close your fingers on the reins, the horse slows down, and you lighten your fingers. That's your obligation. So to me, we need to teach people fundamentally to lighten and to train the horse to do what they do, but not with strong pressures on their mouths or spurs on their sides that are constantly nagging, because those kinds of pressures are really, really bad for animals.
Thank you for mentioning that, because my students are often wondering why we spend, especially at the start of the education, so much time with leading training, with learning to start, to stop, to go away, come in, and just doing this very basic communication even before we are putting on a cabeçon or a bit just on a neck ring or on a halter. But it's, in my experience, so fundamentally crucial to get this basic understanding of each other, to teaching the response, also for giving the horse the real reliability into what are you up to, what is coming next. And
Absolutely, yes.
then
Yeah, that's the predictability element, and it's really vital. And that's why light aids are really important. And when I say light aids, I mean so light that they're invisible. And if we train horses, and as you know yourself, that if we can train horses from the very start, from when they're a foal, to operate from light aids, there are no problems. There will be no behavior problems unless the horse is in pain.
I totally agree with you, and I'm even thinking that most often it's not the horse that we are training, but the human, to get a clear picture of what they are up to. And the moment the human has a clear picture, what they are trying to communicate, it's so much easier.
Yes, I think so. And so I think, that's where education is just so valuable, to teach people a different way. But as I mentioned, I think that the way is through rewarding it, the smallest improvements, and just general education systems. I think that can make a big difference if we all put our minds into that. And then also, probably, I know in the FEI, they get quite a bashing, but I think we should reward small efforts to make things better there, because it's just, see, I see all of these things like my children. If my children did something wrong, well, my children are older now, so they're good. But when they're young, if they did something that was very wrong or just wrong, I wouldn't shame them and I wouldn't punish them. I would just be more empathic to get them to understand what it was that I wanted, rather than to use punishment to stop what I didn't want. And I think we should do the same for institutions, and we would do better if we brought them on board. This is my look, other people have a different way, but this is my way of doing things. If we can bring people on board and do that in those ways, and then it would, as far as I can see, work so much better.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's the way forward. Everything else is not taking us anywhere. Thank you. Let's wrap this up here before we are getting too long. It's so interesting talking to you. But let's wrap this up. Thank you for this lovely discussion with you this morning. Do you have a final message that you want to send out there? How to make a positive impact on training and welfare?
Yeah, well, I always like to say to people to think about the four F's, as I call them now, that we know about the three F's, the importance of friends. Horses are social animals. Let your horses touch each other. It's really good for them. Actually, let them be with each other. That's even better for them. Give them some freedom to do the things that horses like to do. Whether it's rolling or whatever they like to explore, and exercise, all of those elements are part of that particular F of freedom. Foraging, just make sure that they always have plenty of forage, because it's not only for nutrition, it's also for their mind, because they need to be constantly fossicking. They're made to do that because they're grazer browsers and they spend all their time in their evolution doing those things. And so we do that. And then the fourth F, I call that fortitude, because I was looking for another F in English. But fortitude means to be strong. And I think to be mentally strong is really important for horses. And to be mentally strong also requires an understanding of the 10 principles, an understanding of how we train best and how we use our pressures. I think there's no getting away from pressures in riding horses and leading them at certain points in their lives. But pressures can be gentle. We can lead a child across the road. We do need to do that, and that's a pressure. But if we start off with the horse when it's young and teach him really well, we won't need to be doing this retraining of horses. We would have much better and happier horses. So I think train them well and look after them. That's for me the best thing. And therefore for people is to explore more. I always think it's interesting that you hear people in high places say, oh, we should, education's really important. We need to educate people. But often the people who say that are the very ones who don't educate themselves, because when it comes to learning about learning theory, they say, I'm not learning that. And they should. All training is about reinforcement. And we need to understand how reinforcement works and do it better. And that's how we train our children, is through reinforcement. And that's how we should train our animals.
Yeah, thank you very much. I like that very much. And talk to each other instead of about each other.
Exactly. Bring the world together, it's much better.
Yeah, thank you very much for this morning. I hope we will have you back one day. We will link your books and the five domain model and the principles of training in the show notes. And I hope that people take the time for a little bit of continued reading because there's a lot of interesting things to discover out there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.